Chapter 3. Der Übermann, Offermensch. When people ask me, from where did you come up with Ron Swanson? What is he based on? The main answer, after properly crediting Greg Daniels, Mike Schur, and our show's writers, would have to be that a great deal of him comes from my dad, Frederick Rick Offerman. He has been such a hero to me and such an incredible teacher. A stoic, stern, hard-working, yet caring man. I didn't always feel this way. Nothing will piss off a kid more than a dad who wants him to go out and split firewood when he's otherwise employed. I did a lot of whining. It's Saturday morning. My cartoons are on. Are you insane? It's Super Friends. He would not reply. I would not continue arguing. Having lodged my complaint, I would dutifully hustle out and try to get my chores done as quickly as possible so I wouldn't miss Grape Ape. I loved my dad when I was a kid, just as I do today. I idolized him and followed him around, emulating his every move. But he was also very much the disciplinarian in the house. He took matters very seriously because he was providing for a family of six on a junior high school teacher's salary. There wasn't a lot of room in his day for fucking around. As far back as I can remember, my dad has been teaching me lessons about decency and manhood. One of the first things I can recall is him standing next to me to pee, me standing up on a stool, because I was 4 years old and tiny, not because my hog was so long that I needed a stool to pee over the rim, showing me how to hit the porcelain bowl above the water so you don't make a lot of noise to upset the ladies, but below the rim so you don't splatter outside of the targeted area. Aunt Dee had a hand-painted sign in the bathroom off her mudroom. If you sprinkle when you tinkle, be a sweetie and wipe the seedy. As a child, I always felt bad for anybody who would be so crude as to need that advice. They clearly didn't have as kick-ass of a dad as me. My father has always been so conscientious and is such an all-around good guy that I, of course, bridled against most of his lessons and didn't allow myself to acknowledge them for years. All through my childhood, he was teaching me to use tools and how to fix things. My brother and I are two of the only people I know in our circle of friends who can fix any problem at all with a toilet, down to replacing it. Dad's lessons were very clear. Respect the machinery. When someone is driving a machine, they can't always see you and they can't hear you. Know what the machine is and what job it's doing. Whatever it is, it can crush you, or at least hurt your feelings. I remember once down in Dad's basement shop trying to hammer a nail into a board that was resting on my leg. He showed me that when you put the board on a solid surface, you're taking away the give in your joints and your flesh. If you anchor your work, especially with a clamp or at least rest it on a solid surface, then all your force is working on the nail and none is being wasted just holding the board still. Such a great lesson. When you're aiming to apply force to a job with a tool, you have to isolate the focal point of your work as much as possible. Driving a nail, opening a beer, breaking loose a lug nut when changing a tire. Everywhere we went, there were lessons. The hardware store, the grocery store, church, school. In hindsight, the care he took with all of his kids, the four at home, and the dozens and dozens that he taught every year at Shanahan Junior High, was amazingly generous. He used all of the considerable powers at his disposal to turn us into the best possible citizens and hard-working contributors. Being the athlete that he was, combined with the dad he was, he would come to all of my sports games, where he had a great technique for communicating his advice. So many parents come and sit in the bleachers at the basketball game and just scream, "Are you crazy? Are you blind, ref? Kimmy, watch the post up down low. Ah, what are you doing? Watch the baseline." A note, by the way, to parents at sporting events, deriding your child is not going to help anyone, but will make you look like a real fucknut. Moving on. My dad would sit closer down to the floor or the field, and he would wait until I ran in close proximity to him, and he would say, "Watch that number 14 down by the baseline. Bend your knees, will you please? and his voice would come in underneath the cacophony. At the time, I thought, Dad, shut up. I know, I can see him, and I would bristle, but I had to admit his advice had a great success rate. God damn it. One night we were driving home after a game in Joliet, where we had played against Washington Junior High School and lost, and it was snowing. We were in my dad's old blue Chevy on our road, a graveled country lane called Bell Road. We stopped in the empty road a few miles from home, right by the Larkins farm, before Jug Handle Road. Dad was trying to explain something to me about playing defense and was moved to demonstrate what he meant right then and there. We got out of the car in the thick snowfall, and by the light of the headlights, he showed me what he was trying to explain. It was about keeping my knees bent and keeping my focus on the center of the player that I was defending by watching his solar plexus. He can fool you with his head and his eyes and his arms and his legs and even his fanny, but if you stay with his center, he can't fool you. At the time, I thought, Dad, it's 9:45 p.m. I have homework. I'm tired. It's snowing. But that scene stuck with me so deeply. I'll be surprised if I don't end up filming that moment at some point, because it's just beautiful. A lot of Dad's coaching had to do with the fanny, or one's caboose. When you throw a baseball or swing a bat, certainly when you block out for a rebound or set up a jump shot, it's all about how you are disposing the weight of your fanny. Rick Offerman was the kind of ball player about whom Malcolm Gladwell could write a detailed study. In his book Outliers, Gladwell posits that one cannot achieve mastery at an exceptional level over any skill until one has logged 10,000 hours of fundamental practice in that skill set. If that's the case, my dad was probably a master of dribbling and free throws by the time he was 12. When we would play horse with him, the rest of us kids would fall over cracking up at the ridiculous shots he would sink, making the net snap as the ball rifled through its exact center. He was so good, it was funny. I can still shoot free throws myself, thanks to him. We were shooting a Parks and Rec episode in which Ron and Andy are coaching boys basketball, and during a break, I towed up to the line, and although I guess I was 40 that year, it was just like Rick was standing right there with me. Give it a dribble, weigh the ball, bounce it with backspin, dribble, weigh it, shoot. For crying out loud, follow through. It took me a few tries to find my distance, but then I couldn't miss. I made a long string of them in a row, maybe 20, and I just thought, amazing. Look what my dad did. If he had been there, he would have simply said, well, everybody gets lucky once in a while. As a teenager, I would frequently revolt against my dad, as sons will do. I really had bad feelings toward him, resentment. It was all because of his hectoring, which seems totally unfair now, since his hectoring usually consisted of statements like, please be decent today. Please mind your manners at school. If you're gonna do a job, do it right. He kept telling me to be decent, but I was full of mischief at school. I caused a lot of minor trouble, but always found a way to get away with it and come out smelling like a rose. My parents are the best people I've ever met, and I'm not biased. They must have some small failings somewhere, but I can't seem to catalog them. They're just very humble, hardworking, and honorable people. They're families as well, and funny. Maybe we drink and eat a little more than we should. I mean, they make mistakes like anybody does, but they're the most decent goddamn people, and somehow my nature was to see what I could get away with on their watch. I thought, I understand what you're saying about following the rules and having good manners and telling the truth, but let me see what I can get out of this system. At school, I stole matchbox cars from other kids and would then get caught and have to fess up. When I was little enough to sit in the shopping cart at the store, I stole some gum from near the cash register. By the time we got to the car, I had exposed it somehow. My mom said, "What the heck?" which was a $2 cuss word for her. And I had to go back inside and apologize. But somehow I kept doing it. I was a pilferer. I would lie at school, for show mainly. I remember, I think this is the beginning of whatever the need was for attention, or the need to be told I was special. in grade school, raising my hand and telling stories. They'd somehow be relevant to the day's proceedings. The teacher might say, "Today we're going to watch a documentary about how soda is made and bottled," and I'd raise my hand and say, "My uncle once found a mouse in a Coke bottle." I remember getting caught in lies. The school would call home, and my parents would sit me down that night and talk to me. My parents would be very civil about it, shaking their heads and saying, "I don't understand what we're doing wrong. All you have to do is tell the truth. If you tell the truth, then no one can ever hold anything over you." Whatever it was in me, I was certainly not cognizant of it. Sure, I'm embarrassed by it, but I can recognize that it was simply in my nature, own it, and move on. Or is that a lie? I continued to try and put one over on people, but I got much better at it. In high school, I would still famously lie about things, but now mostly to the administration. My cousin and I would commit small acts of graffiti, and then I would pin it on other people. The funny thing was, I was actually in charge of the committee to clean up the graffiti, and I would get out of class to do it. I was definitely very Machiavellian about it. My mom and dad had instilled enough character in me that I was still an A student, and I was still very productive in my endeavors, but there was maybe 10% of my personality that still wanted to somehow trick the world into giving me some sort of get-rich-quick lottery ticket. I suppose I had to learn on my own that there are no shortcuts to anything, be it success or just winning people's attention for the right reasons, because I'd eventually learn that nothing beats hard work. Once I got to college and realized, wow, I'm on my own. Criminy, I have a checkbook and I have to pay bills. I immediately got over the 10% bullshit fraction I had fostered as a teen, thank goodness. Life is hard enough when you're operating 6-2 and even, which is one of my dad's favorite phrases. It means a racing horse's odds are 6-1 to win, 2-1 to place, and even money to show, which I always interpreted to simply mean decent. Life is hard enough when you're operating at 6-2 and even. Fortunately, as a young Illini, I was quickly rescued by my passion for theater. I had always been an A student, as I said, but I would do only just enough work to get 93s and 94s. I didn't care about getting 100%. I ended up graduating in the top 10% of my class. I was in the elite group, but I didn't give a shit beyond maintaining my place with the smarty pantses. Once I got into theater school, that changed overnight. I wanted to be at the top of my class. I wanted to excel. When I got to this new world of, well, sincerity, I thought, holy shit, I have a lot of work to do, and I can't wait to do it. I have a system. By God, I have the tools. I can do this. Hecate's girdle, I will persever. It was drama school. Please go easy on me. And it started working for me right away. About a month into college, I was walking across campus, and I had to stop and call my dad from a payphone. This is 1988. And I said, "Dad, I just want to say that everything you've taught me has just landed. I get it all. And I'm really sorry I was a bit of a dick to you for the last 5 or 6 years. I just want to say thank you. I'm going to make a good go of this. Everything you and Mom have been quietly instilling into me, despite my resistance, it worked." How to be a man. Step 1. Eat a steak, preferably raw. If you can find a juicy steer and just maw a healthy bite off of its rump, that's the method that will deliver the most immediate nutrition, protein, and flavor. Make sure you chew at least 3 times. Step 2. Wash it down with your whiskey of choice, preferably a single malt scotch. My 2 favorites are Lagavulin and the Balvenie, but I won't turn my nose up at Talisker, Oban, Laphroaig, Ardbeg, and many more. The Glens, Kalila, Dalwhinnie, Craigenmore, delicious. Just speaking their names aloud will put hair on thy chest, laddie. Or Irish whiskey. I mean, goddamn, Jameson, Bushmills, Tullamore Dew, Redbreast, Middleton. Or come on, what about the ridiculous amount of good bourbon available right here in the good old U.S. of A.? Your Woodford, your Bullet, and Blanton's, Pappy Van Winkle's, and Four Roses. And there's frankly not a damn thing wrong with Maker's Mark. Not a goddamn thing. Then there's rye. Then there's corn. What a wonderful world in which to call oneself a man. Step 3. Find a socialist and punch him or her in the face. Step 4. Craft a small wooden watercraft from cedar for the hull and domestic hardwoods like ash or walnut or white oak for the gunwales and other trim. Carve a paddle from cherry and Alaskan yellow cedar. Step 5. Make sweet but powerful love to another human, most preferably one who is welcoming of your advances. If you have adhered to steps 1 through 4, how could they resist? Upon climax, unholster your enormous pistol and empty the cylinder as you fire rounds laced with double entendre into the night sky dripping with stars. Or not. Sorry, everybody, totally just kidding. Except, of course, about the whiskey and boat building. I feel like these are some of the ideas that are somewhat misassociated with my public persona, as well as with my TV character Ron Swanson. While I firmly adhere to much of this list, these are not, in fact, what I truly consider to be the steps one must tread if one seeks to attain a quality in life leaning toward what we're here calling manliness. Most of this list pertains more to what I would refer to as the slaking of one's animal thirsts, or just achieving some of the more delicious base pleasures in life. Okay, so here we are. As I mentioned, I seem to have been associated with certain traits of machismo in the zeitgeist, at least for this brief golden moment. I find that fact to be somewhat embarrassing, given my first-hand knowledge of my personal failings and propensity for jackass behavior. But I get it, based on superficially perceived signals of manhood, like a full thick mustache and the ability to use tools. When people ask me questions relating to my manliness, I like to remind them that I am primarily an artist, as an actor, writer, and woodworker. It's also worth mentioning that the two best woodworkers in the Offerman woodshop are women. Beefy, mannish women? No, nothing of the sort. Lovely, talented, strong, young, and smart ladies who continue to learn and profit by the time-honored crafts of handmade wooden furniture and boats. Lee and Michelle are full-time woodworkers. Me, on the other hand, I'm pretty sensitive. I am an entertainer, and I believe that entertainer and artist are not the usual vocations that spring to mind when we picture our idea of the classic man. I am studying at the same school as Lee and Michelle, but they make it to class a hell of a lot more than I do, if you follow. Even in my family, I'm not the one you'd call manly. I'm the one who went away to theater school. I took 2 semesters of ballet, for Christ's sake. Sure, my incentive was that it was the elective in which one could look at girls the best, but still, come on. I wore tights and busted out an entrechat. In layman's terms, that's when you spring straight up in the air and twiddle your pointed toes like scissors 4 times before you land. The talented dancers could achieve an entrechat 6 times, so even in ballet I was outmanned. In most of the country and the world, there are teenagers who could whip me in most contests because they are working hard every day of their lives, swinging an axe, hauling buckets of water, wrangling herds of cattle, hogs, and horses. Conversely, I memorize written lines of brilliant dialogue. Then I go to a trailer where my hair is coiffed and makeup is applied to my face. After that, I squeeze my beefy corpus into specifically unattractive garments before heading into the set where I then deliver my prepared scenes with all the deadpan elan that I can muster. If hungry, I can request a sandwich fixed to my liking. My mewling is easily silenced with a bottle of water or a cup of corn chowder. Please don't misunderstand me. In my life, there are and have been times when I do and did work like a man. I have engaged in seasons of labor on my family's farm. I have framed houses. I worked two summers on a blacktop crew, paving parking lots and driveways in the Illinois humidity. I did some roofing in Chicago. I have known and enjoyed hard work for many of my prime years, but now I am a clown who occasionally gets to mill a tree into table slabs. So, having thus established my current meager rank on the great tourney bracket of manliness in life, let's begin this chapter in earnest. First of all, let's change up our semantics. I wish to examine some human attributes that I think of as, yes, manly, but I would also like to touch upon some personality traits that I feel are charismatic in people of all sexes, that many listeners might instinctively think of as manly, but I will simply call capable. I will perforce be indulging in some gross generalizations here, like all men have strong arms and women wear high heels, but this is obviously not the case for everyone, just making conversation. For the menfolk, chivalry. In a nutshell, there are certain situations in everyday life in which we fellas have the opportunity to behave, well, decently. The initial women's lib movement brought the role of modern-day chivalry into question. If you ladies want to be treated as equals, then shouldn't you be able to open your own car door? The answer to that is quite simply, no, dude, you're an asshole. Women are quite clearly powerful and smart, quite often more than us bros. Their literal bodily connection to the forces of the moon's gravity and resultant tides, not to mention their quite regular performance of the medicine ball through a needle's eye miracle of childbirth, renders them superior to men in many important ways. However, when ladies like to wear shoes that are difficult to move around in, or perhaps a foxy skirt that limits their choices in sitting positions, then it's simply nice to lend them a sympathetic hand. We men generally weigh more than they do, so the wind doesn't prove as much of a threat to us. Perhaps we're not as worried about our hairdos, so the rain is not as big of a bummer. Whatever the adversity, if a man is on hand to provide ease to a lady's cause, I think he's a shitheel if he stands idly by when she could use an umbrella, a handkerchief, or a steady arm. Of course, this is applicable to all people, not just ladies. There are a lot of daddies out there who sometimes need a little aid as they try to change a diaper while juggling groceries and a latte, which I suppose is another part of being manly, or more accurately, like a man. I'm speaking of our tendency as humans to try to do too much. People love to bite off more than they can chew. I consistently arrive at the grocery store for maybe 5 or 6 items, so I get the two-handled plastic basket instead of the cart, and then I invariably see 7 more things I need, including 64 ounces of cranberry juice, and, oh, you know, I really should try this new craft beer from the Russian River Brewing Company, and on until I'm testing the limits of both the thick gauge wire basket handles and my arms and fingers. Why don't I go get a cart? Go fuck yourself. Why don't I ask for directions? A topic much masticated by many before me. I know I'm lost, I know, but I will be goddamned if I'm gonna stop and ask someone in a gas station for help. You behave like that, and I'll be much more quick to call you manly than if you win a boxing match. Grooming. Again, who's making the rules? How does a man groom himself in this modern age? As a character actor, blessed with a thick head of hair and a thicker thicket of bracken upon my face, neck, and lip, I have enjoyed excessively utilizing these accessories in every possible permutation I could muster. I have done Mr. T's majestic hairdo in both brown and platinum white. I often shave my head bald. I have exploited my whiskers for beards, goatees, Van Dykes, mutton chops, and of course, all manner of mustaches. Working in the live theater or on a television series can mean maintaining a certain look for months on end, which means if I'm playing a person with a douchey hairstyle, for Christ's sake, Ron Swanson's coif is called the full douche, or lame facial hair choice, then I might be stuck with said shrubbery throughout my real life, at the lumberyard, at a Little League game, at the post office, you name it. It's been fascinating over the years to study how I am perceived differently by strangers depending on my current hair whisker style. I certainly have rolled around town in a Gucci tuxedo or other fancy Sunday clothes. I have also swaggered about even more in dusty Carhartt pants and jackets. For my money, nothing beats denim and work boots. But whatever the case, people tend to look at you and judge you differently based upon the cover of the book, as it were. I say, who fucking cares? Sure, I think we should do our best to keep ourselves clean for reasons of health as well as politeness. If you want to attract a conservative person, then go ahead, get a square haircut and a clean shave. If you long for a fish fan, that's fish with a PH, well, I don't know what they typically look like, but I'm betting it's more laissez-faire than most. Let your freak flag fly, friend. Do your thing, however it looks. Keep the hygiene up and tell everybody who doesn't like it to kiss your tattooed ass. Another thing that I think goes for everybody, but men especially, be handy. For Pete's sake, I know not everyone can build a canoe or even a popsicle stick. That doesn't mean you need to throw your hands in the air and say, I'm useless. There are many facets of our daily lives that entail minor tool use, which damn near any idiot can master. A pet concern of mine, changing a tire on your vehicle. I know, AAA is great, they really are an amazing service, but don't let the security blanket of their service make you soft. You just might get caught out in the cold without your blanket. Look, every modern car and truck comes with a full kit for changing a flat tire, and I highly recommend you give it a few practice runs in the safety of your own driveway or street before you're stranded in the hills on your way back from Bonnaroo with no cell phone service and a pancake tire. You can use a screwdriver. You can use a hammer. Trust me. If you want to fix a broken closet hook or doorknob, you can. Take your time, read about it online, or better yet, ask someone handy that you know for advice. I can't describe the richly deserved feeling of accomplishment you'll glean from nailing up just one fallen fence board. Your genitals will expand exponentially. Men have been known to gain up to 7/8 of an inch in length and a burgeoning 9/16 of an inch in girth. I've heard tell of ladies who increased their vaginal volume by almost a half liter. Don't take handiness lightly, especially if you hope to increase your manliness, particularly by means of an enlarged vagina. I cannot wrap up this chapter before touching base with one of my all-time paragons of manliness. I speak, of course, of Theodore Roosevelt, also known as Number 26. Here is a piece he wrote to adorn the wall of the lobby at New York City's magnificent Museum of Natural History. Manhood. A man's usefulness depends upon his living up to his ideals insofar as he can. It is hard to fail, but it is worse never to have tried to succeed. All daring and courage, all iron endurance of misfortune, make for a finer, nobler type of manhood. Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die, and none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life and the duty of life. Oh, right. Just in case we might have forgotten why he was the baddest mofo ever to sit the Oval Office bareback. This should firmly remind us. I would especially like to echo his sentiment that it is worse never to have tried to succeed. I would equate this notion with manliness, or more correctly, capability. Damn it all, you have been given a life on this beautiful planet. Get off your ass and do something. It is far too simple these days to lazily coast through an entire lifetime, performing adequately at some thankless job so that one can purchase a roof, a television, a video game console, and a crappy vehicle, only to find oneself in the final days with absolutely nothing to show for those squandered years. My dad always told me, if you're gonna do a job, do it right. And just always do the best you can, and then nobody can fault your effort. Those simple adages saw me through a great many times of adversity, lending me the necessary gravel for finding gainful employment, so that even when I couldn't land an acting job, I could find carpentry work, which paid me dollars that I could then spend on beer. When the storm clouds hit with a little gumption, life can begin to look rather sunny pretty quickly, if you like beer, which men do. Just kidding. My sisters Lori and Carrie can drink circles around me. Not sure if I've mentioned that they're also talented belchers. You'll notice that Mr. Roosevelt doesn't mention punching anybody in the face or firing a weapon of any caliber in his description of manhood. This from a man who so famously led the Rough Riders in their conquest of San Juan Hill and punched a fellow assemblyman in the face during an argumentative session of the New York State Assembly. He does suggest that quality can be found in a chap who lives up to his ideals insofar as he can. This, to me, is another arena in which men and women can prove their worth. Loyalty. Honor. Have a set of rules, a code of ethics that you will do your best to uphold and defend, whether you're on horseback in Cuba in 1898, or at a school board meeting next week, or merely at the water cooler with your co-workers. Pursue decency in all dealings with your fellow man and woman. Simply put, don't be an asshole. Chapter 4. Football Troubadour. 1984. My hometown, the village of Manuka, Illinois, was rather devoid of anything but the most homogenized popular culture. To this day, I don't know where the good independent record store or bookstore is. I'm certain they must exist, perhaps in Morris, the nearby town with a movie theater, but I just never had occasion to find them. My older cousin Angie and my sister Lori could legally drive to town, enabling them to traipse the 20 minutes to the Louis Joliet Mall in the nearby metropolis of Joliet. There, Duran Duran records could be obtained, as well as the other glittering apples of their teenage girl eyes. George Michael and his sassy young band Wham UK, Cyndi Lauper, Adam Ant, Madonna. In fealty to these musical phenoms, the girls would also purchase multicolored bangles with which to festoon their wrists, all well and good for them. But there was little opportunity for a future weirdo like myself to discover the bands that would have thrilled me to pieces, like Talking Heads or Elvis Costello, not to mention Tom Waits or Laurie Anderson. If I wanted to experience popular music, I had but one apparent alternative, and that was to accompany Laurie and Angie to the concert of their choosing, which in 1985 happened to be George Michael and Wham. Was Mr. Michael a bewitching singer and captivating dancer? Certainly. Was I as intoxicated by the lights and glamour as I was terrified by the wilding crowd of screaming, drooling housewives at my first large-scale music venue? You bet. Did any of that make me the tiniest bit inclined to answer in the affirmative when George Michael shouted, "You wanna see my bum?" It did not, no. Clapping along to his dance hits did not induce in me any urge whatsoever to enjoy a peek at his buttocks, as impressive as they must have been after all that wake-me-up-before-you-go-going. Experiences like this one certainly must have nurtured any developing feminine or sensitive side I possessed. So perhaps I entered high school looking for ways to round out the testosterone contingent in my hormonal congress. In the 1980s, there really was not much to do in a small Midwestern town. This recreational vacuum made team sports an incredibly important and prevalent part of our everyday lives. We worshipped the Chicago Cubs with a fervor now reserved for things like Downton Abbey. My older sister Lori and I would compete on car rides in the arena of baseball statistics, quizzed by Dad at the wheel, which we could call up from our encyclopedic mind vaults like Rain Man. Keith Moreland triples in 1982, 2. Fergie Jenkins' last wild pitch, 1983. Easy. Lori and I mowed the front yard on a tractor mower. It was about 80 yards to the road and back. Two laps would take 10 minutes, so we'd take turns, one of us watching the Cubbies while the other mowed. We got so good at it, we'd never stop the mower, just supplant each other while in second gear. Cubs fever? We caught it. This obsession bled liberally into our own participation in baseball and basketball for me, and in softball for Lore. At about 800 students, our high school was small enough that we could participate in almost every activity we desired, meaning sports and then some. Thus, I immediately signed up for band, jazz band, drama club, football, baseball, and basketball. I was also on the student council, eventually serving as its president. In other words, I was an asshole. I had already played my first dramatic villain by this time, the dastardly sheriff Black Bart something or other, in our eighth grade play, Trouble in Cinnamon City. My friend Joe Frescura, a strapping Eagle Scout of a lad, played the protagonist. I suppose he was named Tom or some other bullshit hero name. This was several years before I would learn the efficacy of stage combat, so we opted for full contact face punches in the show's climax, so as not to appear weak before our 13-year-old castmates. In hindsight, the fact that Joe let me leave the stage on my feet with all my teeth speaks to his quiet generosity of spirit, because he could have laid me out with a single clout from his well-fed Italian knuckle sandwich. Joe went on to become an exceptional Army major in the Special Forces. I became an actor, and not just an actor, but a thespian. I didn't have a chance to play football before arriving in high school. I'm not sure I had any business getting into it even then, but I was a decent to good athlete, and I was willing to buy into the whole romance of high school and homecoming and, well, cheerleaders, so I signed up. At age 14 and 15, I was faster than I was tough, so I started out as a receiver and a defensive back, and those first double days, two conditioning practices a day, in July and August 1984, left me so stiff and sore that my Uncle Dan would chase me around, giggling at the pain my aching muscles were causing me. Halfway through the season, I broke my collarbone diving for a pass, which was admittedly pretty badass. At least it was until I started sobbing openly while my mom drove me to the hospital in Morris. We would laugh sob every time she hit a bump because it hurt so goddamn bad that it was funny. When things get bad enough, all you can do is laugh. I feel like my mom saved my fanny like that about once a week throughout my childhood. That injury put a damper on my football career for a while and allowed me to focus on my life in the arts, namely playing the saxophone in band and jazz band, kissing girls, the theater, and more kissing girls. Band was overall a really great experience throughout my school career, but it was also a place for me to explore my inner smartass. I would now offer my belated apologies to our band director, Mr. Woonar, who had to put up with way more hilarious tomfoolery than any human should ever have to countenance. It was in band that I was able to learn how to carry myself as a leader with a sense of humor, whilst indulging my propensity for high-grade jackassery. The key was in discerning just how much mischief I could get away with. The percussionists, for example, took things too far. They drank vodka and beer to excess and then allowed their alcohol to fuel some pretty flagrant insubordination, ultimately finding themselves in the principal's office. I was interested in the grab ass, but not the consequences, so I focused on making people laugh without having my techniques detected by the administration, in this case Mr. Wunar. Apparently, I became rather adept at playing both sides of the fence, earning A's in class while firmly establishing myself as a miscreant purveyor of chuckles. I also, quite understandably, took to the stage whenever I could. As my involvement in the arts expanded, I found myself being cast as more bad guys or anti-hero protagonists, such as Judd Fry in Oklahoma and Joe Ferrone in Up the Down Staircase. And I really began to enjoy the therapeutic aspect of getting to play some version of an asshole. All the weak human inclinations that I had been raised to eschew were qualities in which I could revel on stage, and I could even win an audience's love through misbehaving. This was big, big news. As I worked as a professional on the stages of Chicago in later years, I continued to find that people were willing to reward me for acting like some of the jerks I had grown up around. To wit, football players. Thanks largely to my dad's genes and his coaching, I was pretty good at sports, but I was like the 5th to 7th best guy on any given baseball or basketball team. I was a solid contributor, but I was never the star. I often batted 2nd or 6th. I'd win most improved or best sportsmanship, if anything. I would be among the team leaders in rebounds or assists, perhaps. But by junior year of high school, I had started to fill out, and through no fault of my own, I ended up being one of the hardest hitters on the football team. There were guys on the team who were much more imposing Mack trucks of young men like Todd Reich and Brian Edge, to name a couple of hulks, but some badass instinct was awakened within me. By senior year, I was the headhunter on kickoffs, which meant I was the guy who ran in front of everyone to reach the receiver of the kickoff and exact as much punishment upon him as possible for having the temerity to carry my football. This was insane. I was a former member of Swing Choir, our version of Glee Club. Now, out of nowhere, I was the scary one. Instead of relying solely upon my speed as I had in years past to avoid confrontation on the field, I now realized that I could fucking decimate these other guys, except Reich and Edge and maybe Lance Pelton. We cool, guys? Poor Todd Reich, most likely our school's best athlete during my tenure, who would have definitely been sole captain of the football team in any other year, had to arrive during a year when the coaching staff had determined to have 3 co-captains instead. And so Todd captained the defense from the middle linebacker spot, Tommy Morris captained the offense from the quarterback position, and I captained the secondary defense and special teams. If I could go back and remove this indignity from Todd's shoulders, I would goddamn not. Are you kidding? Most improved rebounder Offerman was now a co-captain of the Fighting Manuka Indians? I wouldn't trade those months of athletic prowess, however specialized, for the world. In those golden moments on the football field, I was revered as a frightening, manlike teenager, and I have never forgotten the Bronson-like confidence this instilled in me. In their defense, many of my teammates were better at sports than I was. In my defense, I set a school record for interceptions in a season. Everybody gets lucky once in a while. Hustling to football practice from, say, a rehearsal for Oklahoma created an interesting situation. Of course, some of the team members were macho, homophobic guys of the sort that have come to be considered the norm for American high school football players, also known as bullies. But in reality, most of the team was comprised of really nice guys with whom I'd grown up playing sports. However, I do remember one specific bully, a guy my age named Biff, who wanted everyone to know that he was the dominant male in any given situation. Sadly, even then, we all knew that Biff's family had undergone some turmoil at home, of the sort that was most likely the source of his Steven Seagal-style posturing and preening, but that didn't make them any easier to swallow. Suffice it to say, that Biff was not happy with the choir boy come co-captain headhunter. If you were to rewind a paragraph, you would notice that Biff was not the name of any of the three co-captains, even though our Biff had been excelling at football since he was in something called Pee Wee. Biff worked his tail off, a strong, fast, and gifted running back, but his fate was such that he was maybe the number five guy on the squad. Now, this may be distressing news for Ron Swanson fans, but I have never in my life been in a fist fight. Really never even close. The closest I ever came was being taunted by Biff in the locker room or at a couple of barn parties. By the way, Biff was and still is a good guy overall. In the hallway between classes, we were friends. He recognized his antagonizing tendencies even then, but like an alcoholic or a fan of the Dave Matthews Band, he ultimately couldn't control his self-destructive addiction. My dad had taught me to never throw the first punch, and so when Biff would want to unload some rage onto my face, I would simply suggest he go ahead and do it. I would say, "I'm not going to fight you, Biff, so you better just beat me up," while silently shaking in my boots. Biff was the kind of person who used the term faggot rather liberally, and really never to describe a smoldering bundle of sticks in the fireplace in a Victorian novel. Biff had a violence in him that was frightening, and I'm very thankful for my dad's lesson, because if I had ever engaged young Biff in fisticuffs, I fear I would have been very seriously, well, fucked up by him. Instead, he would say something imperious and admonishing, ending with, "I thought so, faggot," before heading back to the keg or his locker, depending on the location. This happened, I believe, three times over 8 months or so. It's not the stuff of a coming-of-age film, so Disney, please don't option this chapter. It's just the closest real-life experience I had to some of the violence I now love to pretend to in my day job. I was to learn later in theater school of Aristotle's observation that theater is the mirror held up to society. But I was already inadvertently picking up on that heady notion by mere good fortune. By and large, I was learning to be decent to people in real life while engaging in delicious human indiscretions in my performances. Think about it. If you perform A Clockwork Orange on stage, you can be paid cash money to indulge in both ultra-violence and a little bit of the old in-out, in-out. Meanwhile, I was beginning to get an inkling of what I wanted to be when I grew up. Sophomore year, I was in this horrible play called The Primetime Crime. It was a wacky caper play starring Inspector Clouseau, the Pink Panther, Kato, Starsky and Hutch, Kojak, Beretta. It was truly ungodly. Why must high school plays be so ham-handed? There's so much excellent writing available that must certainly be acceptable to any school board, even creationist idiots. To Kill a Mockingbird? The Crucible? Jesus, I'll even take some Neil Simon over The Primetime Crime. The first good play I was in was Up the Down Staircase from the 60s, in the vein of Blackboard Jungle. I played the sort of brooding James Dean role. It was funny. I took a lot of shit from the football team because I'd have to miss practice to go to a speech competition or band performance. But then those same meatheads, except Reich and Edge, totally cool dudes, not meatheads, would be screaming and cheering at the curtain call. It seemed that in my small pond, I was halfway decent at entertaining people from the stage. That was enough to send me on the road to theater school, where I promptly learned that I sucked. I hadn't fully discovered the value of my own unique voice. One wasn't allowed to take speech or creative writing classes until junior or senior year, but I really took to them once I got there. I was also a very proficient sax player, but my teachers never took me to the point of inspiration, inspiring me to create my own sound. They simply taught me to read off of sheet music as well as I could. In jazz band, you'd get the music for, say, Sweet Georgia Brown, and there'd be a tenor sax solo for 16 bars, a suggested solo written in, and then chords as well, so an adept improviser could just jam his or her own solo based on the provided chords. No one ever suggested that to me, and I needed the suggestion. I didn't think to try it on my own, nor did I possess the natural ability, so I'd just play the suggested solo in a kick-ass way, as far as I could tell, at the time. I got more weird in speech class, where I'd do odd comedy bits for my speeches. The video camera was new on the scene, if you can imagine. This was 84 or 85. And stupidly, teachers would let you do a video report instead of writing a paper, which I think was just idiotic, because we took full advantage of the opportunity to shoot a 10-minute video instead of spending hours writing a dreary report on some boring topic. My cousin Ryan and I did an infamous joint video project for French class. I wish I still had it. Someone from the class, I think a girl who was sweet on Ryan, stole it. Looking at you, Jennifer Groot. It was the two of us in different scenarios, like me sitting in a chair in front of a roaring fireplace with a dog, a newspaper, and a pipe. I'd say in French, "Welcome. You're probably wondering why I'm sitting in this domestic situation with my pipe, my newspaper, my dog, and a fire. Let me explain." Then Ryan was happily making pasta at the stove, then he was in the shower, then I was vacuuming, all the while laying out clear French exposition. It was all very deadpan. "Oh, excusez-moi," as we pleasantly described domestic tasks and personal hygiene. "C'est hilarant, hilarious." So we were into making these weird random comedy videos, but we were about 2 decades away from understanding that was a thing. It was just us being funny for a class, and more importantly for ourselves, which is a significant flag by which one can navigate toward one's voice. A flag entirely outside of my comprehension at that point. I remember attending these speech contests where I tried the extemporaneous category on for size. There was a kid from the suburbs of Chicago, I think his name was Bix, and he was a very flamboyant, queeny kid who was very, very funny. He was basically doing stand-up at age 14 with this incredibly sophisticated, fully written show, hardly extemporaneous, but who's counting, with a character based upon Robin Leach from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Only it was a swishy version, like a Bravo show this kid had created. It was, in a word, amazing. Little me, a literal freshman in this arena, thought, "Holy shit, this kid is ready for the big time. He's like the Uncle Milty of Grundy County." If I'd known who the hell Uncle Milty was. I was presenting material like, "Welcome to the Sandwich County Fair. Get ready for the spitting contest." And then I was enacting a spitting contest. I don't remember the setup, really, but I remember that wind was an issue, and at one point I kept catching the spit on my hand, which involved some kick-ass mime and sound effects or Foley work. I was trying to draw from my own strange experience, but had yet to learn the lesson of applying hard work to my act, to persevere in the face of the damning criticism of a Central Illinois high school speech contest. My bits were certainly unique, but I interpreted those first flops as the ultimate judgment of my voice, so I didn't try again with that brand of wisecrack for many years. Enter Mr. Pat Luther, or Lex, as we obviously would have called him, a term of great affection for, remember kids, this is back when Gene Hackman permanently endeared himself to audiences as a subway-dwelling, bald-headed, charismatic-as-shit Lex Luthor. Mr. Luther was the top-tier English teacher at Manuka, and it was in his creative writing class senior year that I really enjoyed a first taste of what my weird voice could achieve. P.S. He's the first person who ever said anything to me like, "You should check out the Royal Shakespeare Company. They do this play called Hamlet, a hero." One day near the end of the year, we assembled in his class for our final exam. He took a 1-page essay, printed in a large font, long before we knew the term font, and taped it to the wall in front of the class with about 1 inch of masking tape. He said, "Here's your subject matter. You have 90 minutes to compose an essay upon this." I did not even read the posted text. Instead, I immediately shat out an entirely fabricated history of masking tape, starting with some Native American origins involving applying sorghum to the leaves of the sumac tree and so forth. I confidently handed it in and strode from the room. You might expect that the next day I would have received some sort of admonition from my man Lex, but if so, you'll be disappointed, because really, for the first time in my life, someone got me. I was 17 years old, and I knocked the old T-head on his ass. He praised my paper and read it to the class, celebrating my initiative to think outside the box. I'm sorry if this is a little braggadocio, but I believe this to be a noteworthy moment, the first tangible triumph of my nonconformity. I had a good season of football, and then I was a smartass, and I got an A, and I was singled out by the teacher. Two accomplishments in 17 years. By God, I was on my way. Don't be an asshole. I find it consistently difficult to get around the notion that we are all, in our very natures, assholes. I am an asshole. I'm afraid you are also. That's why the conversation about good manners even exists in the first place. We're cognizant, curious beings capable of philosophical thought, nuclear physics, repeating Nerf weapons, global consciousness, Glade air fresheners, and sentient automobiles, but we're assholes first. This is because before we can begin to argue mortgage rates and tuition hikes, before we can roll up our sleeves and thread a perfusion catheter into the cholesterol-choked artery of today's society, we, every one of us, must first replenish our mammalian bodies with food and water while establishing and maintaining a comfortable climate around our bodies through the employment of garments and heating cooling systems. Before we can arrive at the office to resume our efforts to improve, say, worldwide Muslim-Christian relations or the infrastructure of the Haitian public utility systems, we must commune, and more to the point, commute, with thousands of other animals upon ever-increasingly crowded roadways and public transit vehicle systems. It is during these more basic elemental steps in our day that we reveal our true colors, as assholes. Our bodies tell us frequently, in no uncertain terms, to do things that society has deemed inappropriate or quite often illegal. I'm talking about the animal voice deep inside us all that we've learned to repress through socialization. Hey, Dave, look at that ripe young female cheering for the sports team. You should make some babies occur. Or, excuse me, Jorge, that other family is in front of you in line at the Reuben truck. Your own family could claim all of the delicious sandwiches and grow stronger if you simply kill that first family. We humans contain within us instinctual signals, influencing us toward the perpetuation of our species, specifically our own tribes or family units, often to the detriment of others. That's just how nature works. What's amazing is that we have largely contained these urges to the point of successfully checking out of a crowded Whole Foods without decapitating that crunchy, granola-haired hustler dude trying to squeak 14 items through the express lane. When the sign clearly states 12 items or less, you think we aren't all going to be counting your fucking items, bro? But we don't strike. We take a deep breath and feel better for another day of carnage-free foraging at the grocery store. As civilization developed, we learned to establish some rules and guidelines, laws, if you will, to convince ourselves that it's not right to heed these animal urges. Okay, everybody, I know we used to just rip one another's throats out if we wanted to claim, say, a certain hunting territory for our own, but we're all deciding in this new committee, or let's say Congress, that we formed, that that's not cool anymore. We're going to lay down some notions about personal property and the ways in which we can violate these notions, and we're going to establish some punishments to hopefully deter us from, you know, raping and killing one another, mostly the weak people. Over the centuries, we have continued to evolve these notions so that every citizen receives a fair shake, and by God, we're still working on it. For you see, gentle listener, it's complicated. In a society where to the victors go the spoils, it can be difficult for said victors to wrap their heads around fair treatment or rights for all the people, especially those who have been defeated or dominated in one sense or another. For example, slavery. Although versions of slavery have been prevalent all over the world throughout history, I'll focus on American slavery during the last few centuries. We, Europeans, were caught up in a system that entailed the brutal, inhuman capture and transport of brown-skinned Africans to the United States, where they would be sold like work animals to perform labor in the fields and houses of farms and plantations. Full-on, flagrant, fucked-up assholery. Unthinkable. This horribly criminal system existed for hundreds of years before the white folks finally copped to its being not super cool. It took a long time for the whites to wrap their heads around the idea of sharing this nation, which incidentally was brutally stolen by them from the indigenous tribes, in equality with the dark-skinned people whom they had once owned like mules. How did this ever occur? Assholes. The rules were being made by assholes. These decisions were handed down from assholes on high and carried out by, you guessed it, assholes. So, thankfully, we got that bullshit straightened out on paper, but we're still trying to heal the wounds of that and countless other genocides and discriminations and ass-fuckings that we humans have handed one another over the years. The early transgressions that our laws sought to prohibit involved a violating pole axe or spear of one brand or another. Many crimes of action required a sharp-bladed weapon with which to pierce the skin or property of the victim, or an actual penis with which to violate another in the most intimate of breaches. By now, civilization has done, it must be said, a pretty stand-up job of reducing these more overt asshole moves with the promise of strict repercussions. Prison, death, what have you. Terrific. But, folks, we have got us a very long way to go. I here proffer my opinion that we the people are still being raped on a daily basis, but it's a much longer, much slower fucking. The aggressors are the lobbyists for big tobacco and for guns and for pharmaceuticals and for agribusiness. And their filthy, turgid cocks are enormous, probing ramshafts made of money. But wait, I thought this book was a lighthearted look at living one's life deliciously. That's all well and good, fat boy, but you cannot just blithely drift through life in your canoe whilst turning a blind eye to the bullshit going on around you. Really, all religious teachings can be boiled down to just be cool, don't be an asshole. The teachings of Jesus, of Muhammad, of Buddha, of Yahweh, Dionysus, Oprah, Yoda, and the rest, Confucius. All we need to be told is that we are all presented with a similar challenge in life, which is, you will encounter tests every day. You can serve yourself, or you can serve others. Now, before I dive headfirst off a self-righteous cliff like a motherfucking juggernaut, let me point out that I count myself as not only a human, but a fucking American white guy with a decent brain and set of life skills, which means I am, by birthright, a major asshole. I come by it honest. It's the first rule of Fight Club, admitting you're an asshole. Once I saw this truth and swallowed it, an excellent technique developed, one that I believe makes my life much more calm and much less desperate. Therefore, much more delicious. The technique is, let the others go first. At the airport, at the grocery store, at the pleasure chest, hey-o! The calmer I become, the more I enjoy my day. The more I enjoy my day, the more people enjoy me, and the more they want to see me in my enjoyment. Eventually, they want to see me enjoying my day on the set of their film playing Holly Hunter's husband for Diablo Cody. Boom. Turns out all I had to do was keep my cool. I can hardly dive into this topic without immediately citing the storied heavy traffic of my hometown of 16 years, Los Angeles, California. Crosstown trips continue to take longer and interminably longer with each passing year. In the arena of the streets of L.A., a great many motorists reveal themselves to be lacking in moral fiber. Their integrity is questionable at best to begin with, perhaps because Hollywood, more than any other American community, is the city of dreams. Los Angeles County is choking with these supplicants to glittering visions, like that of impressing one's handprints in the cement sidewalk outside of Man's Chinese Theater or delivering a sexual pleasuring to a studio head. Of course, most of us will never realize even the first flirtation of such a lofty climax, and the frustration with that status quo can foment quite a bitter, impatient, aggressive driver. I can speak to this sensation, as for my first years in L.A., I felt like I was in an invisible queue, bombarded daily by reports of all the goddamn guys in front of me succeeding by inches, wedging me out of TV pilots and film roles. When I learned to ignore the business and instead focus on woodworking and my love life, I merely calculated my drive time, adding a 15-minute cushion for chilling out, and Christ Almighty did my mood improve.